Here on FM, it's our Book of the Week, Ghetto Side by Jill Leovi, which explores the disproportionately high homicide rates among LA's young black men through the story of one devastating murder and its investigation. The LAPD's driven and determined detective John Skaggs is following two promising leads in his quest to track down the killers of Bryant Tinelli, the 18-year-old son of fellow detective Wally Tinelli. Ghetto Side is read by Roshan Stone.
John Skaggs now had two names in connection with the killing of Bryant Tinelli. Gang members called No Brains and Baby Man. It took him 2 weeks of wrangling with the sheriff's jail bureaucracy to figure out exactly who and where No Brains was. No Brains' real name was Derek Starks, and his current jail stint was related to a parole violation in connection with a car crash. The car had collided with a telephone pole on May 15th, 4 days after Bryant's death. The arrest report said Starks had been driving. He had a companion with him when he crashed, a girl. This last detail was a bonus. A girl in a gang car might be an opening. Ever since a witness had mentioned that No Brains hung out with a good girl, Skaggs had been attuned to this possibility. The girl's name was Jessica Midkiff. Skaggs first met Jessica in a small detention cell in the basement of the 77th Street station. She was 22. She was in gray sweatpants and a tiny, lightweight top, inappropriate for the December night. Her feet were bare. She was sniffling and sobbing with fear. Skaggs asked Midkiff if she knew why she was there.
"No, I promise I don't," she stammered.
Skaggs responded in his unhurried way. "Okay," he said. "You and I are going to talk." But Midkiff was already talking as fast as she could. She had anxiety, she explained between sniffles, meaning some kind of disorder. And she'd been trying to do good.
I'm not going to lie. I was a prostitute for years, and I checked myself into rehab for that.
She was terrified of losing custody of her young daughter, she said. Skaggs had thought Midkiff might be a suspect, the knowing getaway driver, and he was geared for an adversarial interview. He had planned to corner her, to force some slip that would put her at the crime scene. Now, faced with her near hysteria, he dialed it back. He told her something had happened the previous May. At the mention of May, Midkiff instantly began babbling about her ex-boyfriend. "What's his name?" Skaggs demanded, suddenly sharp.
"Derek," she said.
Derek Starks, or No Brains, clearly brought up all sorts of issues for her. He had been calling her from prison. She was in high anxiety about it. She broke down.
"I just want to wash my hands of these people, and I can't get rid of them," she wept.
"Yeah, we can," Skaggs replied calmly. He read Jessica her Miranda rights and then got down to business. Jessica Midkiff had been born in Los Angeles. She had lived badly. She was turning tricks in cars by the time she was 14. Her grandparents still lived stable, homebound lives. Her mother was raising her little girl. At one point she enrolled in continuation school and was proud to be elected class secretary. But men always found her. Midkiff's story was typical of South End prostitutes. That is, it was sordid, dramatic, and monotonous. But Midkiff was atypical in some ways. For one thing, she was not a junkie. She appeared bright, despite her lack of formal education. She had an excellent memory. What Skaggs couldn't see was that she was at one of those rare crossroads in her life. She was telling the truth. She wanted to change, but didn't know how. There would be no storybook ending for her. But this interview was a turning point. It would change everything for them both. He asked her about the events of May 11th, the day of Bryant Tinelli's killing. She hesitated, eyes brimming.
I don't want to die, she whispered. They're going to kill my family.
You have a promise from me that I will not leave your family hanging, Skaggs told her. Midkiff's hesitation was brief. She began,
I wanted to drive his truck. I was so eager to drive his stupid truck.
At the memory, she suddenly laughed bitterly. On the day Bryant Tinelli died, Midkiff had been in the truck with Starks, she said. They picked up two dark-skinned teenage boys, one of whom was Devin Davis, whose gang moniker was Baby Man. They drove north to the 80s, and Starks handed one of the teenagers a gun. She had believed it was just another of Starks' outings. She had thought he was going to get girls for the two teenagers, find them weed or buy liquor for him. The boys jumped out and went around a corner. Midkiff heard gunshots. Then the car doors opened and the pair jumped back in. Starks yanked her into the passenger seat and took the wheel. Devin Davis was amped up and bragging.
I'm proper, he said.
Starks hushed him and turned the music up. At last, Skaggs asked her to testify in court.
I don't even care about me anymore.
I'll do it, Midkiff said. She began to cry again, worried her family would be killed.
They'll do it,
she told Skaggs. He told her that he would be scared too, if it were him. Devin Davis, or Baby Man, was 17 in the first weeks of 2008, in custody at a youth camp at the foot of the Mojave Desert. He was an awkward-looking kid, with a large head, high round cheeks, and very large brown eyes. Skaggs knew what he wanted from Devin Davis, a full confession. Skaggs had interrogated hundreds of murder suspects, and a striking number had confessed, at least partially. This was not entirely a tribute to Skaggs' talent. Confessions were astonishingly common in ghetto-side cases. One detective maintained he'd gotten some version of a confession on almost every case he had ever cleared. Skaggs couldn't understand why suspects confessed, but this particular detective, who ascribed sentimental motives to everyone, even murderers, had a theory. He believed it was the burden of guilt. Murder, he suggested, had a kind of existential weight. One had to be very hardened indeed not to be bested by it. On the afternoon of January 14th, John Skaggs' partner picked up Devin from youth camp and drove him back through the desert to the 77th Street station, his hands cuffed in front of his body for the long journey. Skaggs wanted to secure an advantage over Devin from the start. He had devised a couple of ruses, suggesting to him that the police had evidence that didn't exist, including a fictitious video that Skaggs claimed had been shot by a security camera. The goal was just to freak him out, he said later. He also wanted a read on Devin. Skaggs gave Devin a soda and asked if he wanted lunch. Devin said no. It was 2:30 p.m. Skaggs began talking aimlessly about the investigation. He declared his intention to be up front. Then he wandered. Every gesture and inflection assured Devin that he was being clear and direct. But the words delivered only discursiveness and confusion. It was infuriating and effective. The tactic had served Skaggs well for years. Circling was his weapon of choice. Eventually, Skaggs said he had found Derek Starks's, or No Brain's, phone number on a slip of paper in Devin's bedroom. Devin demanded to see it. Skaggs obliged, producing a page of the murder book. Devin looked and switched gears instantly.
I know him, he said. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm an honest person.
So, here's where we're at, Devin. There's some snitches.
The word snitches caught Devin's attention.
So, I'm in big trouble?
Well, what I'm saying is, I've got people saying you shot a boy.
So I...
So I'm getting in trouble for it, right?
Hold on. Easy, Tiger. Skaggs downplayed it.
He returned to his meanderings, saying that snitches had said Devin had been put up to the crime by Starks, but then burying the allegation in lesser ones, saying Devin had done this and that. Devin cut him off.
Okay, but are you going to tell me who is snitching on me?
If this was to go to court, absolutely you're going to find out. Devin started. Going to court? He wasn't going to court, was he?
Skaggs spoke very slowly. He would prepare his findings. The district attorney would decide what to do. Then he said, "What do you think the district attorney's going to do to the person that's in the video busting on some kid?" Devin let out a sharp burst of air.
"I'll be there for the rest of my life. I got a baby on the way."
Devin began to cry. Skaggs made a seamless transition.
"For me to ask you questions, well, you've had your rights read to you before, right?"
Skaggs made a game of it, asking Devin if he knew his rights well enough to recite them. Devin tried, then trailed off. He was in his own world, tears flowing.
"I'm never going home."
He sat crumpled over the table, a desperate, ailing, injured 17-year-old boy. Skaggs didn't flinch. He came at Devin.
"I want to know why."
"He put me up to it,"
Devin said, his voice suddenly clear.
They had been in the room nearly 45 minutes. Devin was getting hysterical.
"I'm going to jail for life. I'm 17 and I'm going to the pen."
Suddenly Skaggs raised both hands. Clap. For a moment the sound hung in the air. Skaggs was trying to make Devin focus.
"So listen," Skaggs said.
Clap.
"What happened that day?"
Clap. Clap.
And Devin broke.
Suddenly he was talking so fast the detectives couldn't keep up. He was giving them the whole case.
"He said, 'We go over here. I was in the car. I was with the burner, all right? I got out of the car, closed my eyes, and I just started doing it. I don't know why. I was scared. I just wanted to have friends. That's all I wanted. I didn't think you had to do all of that.'"
2 decades, Skaggs had been doing this, extracting confessions. Some easily, some less so. And he was still surprised every time. He had hoped to get a confession from baby man Devin Davis. Not needing it, not absolutely, but knowing it would tie up the case. Yet when the moment came, it was breathtaking. At 4 p.m., the interview ended. Skaggs walked out. He felt drained, as if he'd just run a marathon. But he knew he'd done it. The case was cleared. Skaggs had barely spoken to Wally Tonelli through the whole course of these events. But as the case broke open, and Skaggs became sure it would be solved, he picked up the phone. For the first time, he spoke one-on-one to the colleague he barely knew. He told Tonelli that arrests were pending. Then he fell silent and waited, listening as Tonelli wept at the other end of the line.
And Rashan Stone continues to read Ghetto Side by Jill Leovi tomorrow. The abridger was Miranda Emerson, the producer Elizabeth Allard. The American YouTube star Chrissy Chambers explains why she's making a stand against revenge porn. And we'll hear about the Homeless Football World Cup in Woman's Hour in a couple of minutes. But first, let's hear from James Naughtie about Book Club this weekend.
We've chosen one of the surprise hits in the book world in the past year as our June read for Book Club. It's Do No Harm, Stories of Life, Death and Brain Surgery by Henry Marsh, a dramatically honest account of his work as a neurosurgeon, one of the riskiest undertakings in surgery. Here Henry Marsh described the day-to-day tribulations and the joys of life as a neurosurgeon in Book Club this Sunday at 4 o'clock.